Welcome back to the program. My guest today, Kishore Mahbubani, argues that the world has seen more positive change in the past 30 years than in the 300 years that preceded it, that the global middle class is growing, poverty levels have fallen, major wars have decreased, and people are better educated and better informed than ever before. The world is connected in new ways, and in many respects we are at the dawn of a new age. Kishore Mahbubani is a writer, a professor, a former Singapore diplomat who served twice as ambassador to the United Nations. He is the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his newest work, The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Kishore Mahbubani, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
In many ways, you're very optimistic about the way in which the world is going, the fact that the 7 billion people on this planet are potentially more interconnected, more reliant on each other than arguably at any other time in history, and that although this change is difficult for a lot of people to grasp today, that you're optimistic about where we're going right now.
It's actually quite stunning. It seems almost as though we are programmed to only hear bad news and not good news. And people sort of are not aware that in terms of war and peace, the number of people dying in conflicts is the lowest it's ever been. Global poverty is disappearing. The UN is going to meet its Millennium Development Goal of halving global poverty. And at the same time, global middle classes are exploding, you know. In Asia alone, the number of middle class is going to grow from 500 million today to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. And these are remarkable changes that are happening across the world. And at the same time, as you mentioned, we are becoming very interdependent, living together, in a sense, as I say in the book, almost on the same boat globally. And we should recognize it so that we can take care of our global boat together.
And yet one of the problems that we seem to be facing, and you talk about this, is that nobody is in charge. Nobody seems to be the captain of that global boat.
Yeah, that's exactly why I wrote my book at this stage. Because I say that, you know, in the past, when 7 billion people lived in 193 separate countries, it was like living in 193 separate boats with a captain or crew taking care of each boat. And rules to make sure that the boats didn't collide. That was a 1945 rules-based order. But today, the 7 billion people no longer live on 193 separate boats. They live in 193 separate cabins on the boat, with captains and crews taking care of each cabin, but no one taking care of the boat as a whole. And that obviously is a danger that we face, that we have to deal with. And that's why I argue very strongly in the book that while we cannot have global government, that's obvious, we can strengthen institutions of global governance that we have already, whether it's the UN, the IMF, the World Bank. We can make them stronger and more responsive to the global needs of the day.
And yet, while technology and so many other aspects that have bound everybody together have moved at a rapid pace, that global infrastructure that you're talking about, particularly with respect to leadership, has been bogged down and really unable to keep up with these changes that are taking place. And that clash seems to be at the heart of some of the conflicts that we see today.
Well, no. You're right. I mean, the most of humanity is not aware of how small and interdependent we have become. But at the same time, in terms of conflicts, the good news, as I mentioned in my book, conflicts have come down very sharply. And indeed, governments, even without in some ways intending to do so, are cooperating more and more. And you saw that, of course, at the height of the global financial crisis. In April 2009, when the G20 leaders suddenly realized that they were in the same boat and the global economy would crash if they didn't cooperate, they came together and launched a major stimulus package to save the global economy. And that's an instance of how the world can cooperate in the face of a crisis. So what I argue in the book is that don't try to create a committee to save the world after the crisis. Try to create the committee to save the world before the crisis. And that's why I'm writing this book at this stage.
One of the things that you talk about is that war is becoming, as you say, kind of a dying industry, that although we pick up the paper every day and see conflict and danger in parts of the world, that warfare itself is on the decline. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, this is the trouble, I guess, with newspapers. You know, newspapers sell bad news. If they only printed good news, nobody would buy it. And it's so tragic that so few people are aware that the number of people dying in conflicts, you know, as recently as the 1950s, used to be about 500,000 a year, and that number has fallen to 30,000 a year. That's a dramatic decrease. And if you go around the world, I mean, of course, you leaving aside Syria and Mali, and remember that most of these are internal conflicts. In fact, if you look at interstate conflicts, which is how conflicts are traditionally fought between two states, the danger of especially an interstate conflict within any two major powers is the lowest it has ever been in human history.
What should we come away with, then, from the fact that we're seeing so many intrastate conflicts? And what is the potential danger of that? Is it more dangerous in some ways?
No, actually, I think that we, you know, remember George W. Bush used to say regularly, we live in a dangerous world, which is getting more dangerous. Actually, empirically, he's wrong. In terms of the number of people who face the prospect of dying from conflict, is again the lowest it has been in human history. Now, of course, from time to time, some countries will break down and some countries will have civil wars and internal conflicts that you have in Syria. But by and large, if you read Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature,
right,
he describes quite powerfully how even internally within countries, violence is diminishing significantly in human life.
Given all of this, why do we see such pessimism in the West, particularly from the United States and Europe?
Well, I think that's a very good question that you're asking, you know, because I guess, you know, the reason why many in the West, both in Europe and United States, feel pessimistic because they took it for granted that they would continue progressing and doing well no matter what happened in the rest of the world. I think what's changing now is that the rest of the world is becoming more and more competitive, and I think the United States can compete in this competitive world. But the leaders of America have got to tell the American people that now you really got to stand up and compete in a much more competitive environment. And just to say, we can do it. So if you say, for example, when you travel in Asia and you meet young people, they're absolutely convinced that tomorrow will be better than today. But when you come to Europe and sometimes in America, the pessimism is quite striking.
What do you think lies at the heart of that? What is it that we're not understanding that is driving that pessimism in the West?
Well, I think it's a lack of information, a lack of awareness. As you know, every country has got its own national prejudices, you know. And in the case of the United States, it is politically suicidal for any American politician, for example, to say, hey, it is possible that the U.S. economy may become number two in the world. And that's going to happen, you know, within 5 to 10 years. But no American politician can say that because you're considered almost un-American to talk about America becoming number two. But these are the new realities that you've got to discuss openly and candidly in America. And this is where I think my book tries to be very helpful to Americans to say, hey, there's a new world coming, and if you prepare for it, you will thrive and do well too. But you've got to understand the new world that is coming.
Talk a little bit about how new it really is. You know, we hear over and over when people are talking about the financial markets and what's going on in the financial realm, when somebody says this time it's different, that's always sort of a key word to run for the hills. You argue that this really is significantly different when we talk about what's going on in the world today. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think you may be aware that before this, I wrote a book called The New Asian Hemisphere,
mm-hmm.
in which I pointed out that from the year 1 to the year 1820, for 1800 out of the last 2,000 years, the two largest economies in the world were always China and India. And it's only in the last 200 years that Europe took off and United States of America took off. But the last 200 years of world history, when you view it against the past 2,000 years of world history, have been a major historical aberration. And all historical aberrations come to a natural end. So it's quite natural for China and India to return in strength and do well. But this doesn't mean that this is a zero-sum game, that the return of China and India doesn't have to mean that Europe and America have to go down. They may lose the relative shares of the global economy, but the absolute size of their national economies can still continue to grow and become bigger. But at the same time, as they become more vigorous and more competitive, you've got to figure out the areas in which America is competitive in and do well and succeed in this world. But you've got to change and adapt when there's creative destruction going on in some industries.
One of the things you talk about that is also different this time is the degree to which technology and social networking and everything that goes along with it has created a different level of citizen engagement. What's the impact of that on a broader global framework?
Well, what's remarkable, we live in, when I grew up in the 1950s, let's say I could only dream about getting an encyclopedia, Encyclopedia Britannica. I dreamt of it all my childhood, and then I never got it because it was too expensive. Today, you know, as long as you have any kind of small tablet which you can now get for $50 in many parts of the world, you can get access to Wikipedia. And Wikipedia has proven to be as reliable as Encyclopedia Britannica in some ways. And you can get access to tremendous amount of information. So the access to information for the vast majority of the world's population, that's something that never existed for most of human history. And this is something new that is happening. Is something that's even more remarkable. When professors put their courses online in places like Coursera and other places, hundreds of thousands of people are signing up for these courses. And this is amazing, you know. So the number of people in the world who can get the most advanced information and work with it has never been greater in human history.
Why is it that world leaders seem to not be understanding this, that's in many cases where some of the failure is, that they're not understanding the degree and the scope of this change?
Well, you know, I'm not surprised that many democratically elected leaders are not paying attention to global trends because, you know, they are elected by their local constituencies. They're elected to take care of the local problems that they have in their constituency. And if they come across as a global statesman, they might lose their job. And I mean, if you look at even at the case of Barack Obama, who, as you know, is very open and enlightened in many ways, when he got elected to office in 2008, he said that he would look after climate change and deal with it. But when he was running for re-election in 2012, his campaigners were told, don't mention climate change because it's toxic, you know. So if he had said that we have a global responsibility to take care of the global climate change, he would not have been elected. That's why he could only say it after he was elected and not before.
Talk about climate change, because it's a good example of a whole list of global problems that we face that can only really be dealt with on a global level.
Yes, indeed. And I hope that, you know, someone like Al Gore has done a great job in terms of raising awareness about climate change, both in America and globally. But I hope he can be more effective in persuading the U.S. Congress and U.S. Senate to do something about it. Because unfortunately, while public awareness has grown, most of the politicians in America who unfortunately are beholden to special interest groups are reluctant to take it on because they know that to take care of climate change, all of us have got to make some kind of sacrifice in one way or another. And it's important for the richest countries of the world to lead the way by example, by showing that they will sacrifice more than the poorest countries. But the word sacrifice, as you know, is absolutely almost like sacrilegious and no one can mention it.
The other aspect of this is that one of the things that we're missing by not looking at this global landscape Are nations learning about best practices, seeing what worked to solve problems in other nations, and using that experience from time to time to solve other national problems?
Yes, indeed. The most remarkable thing that is happening in the world today, and that's also another reason why in some ways the world is becoming more peaceful, is that governments all over the world are learning best practices from each other, how to grow their economies, how to make sure that the standards of living go up. And the one reason why the Asian countries are thriving and one reason why Asian middle classes are exploding is because Asian governments realize that they've got to open up their economies and sign free trade agreements and allow more trade and investment across their borders. And by allowing that, that's why living standards are rising dramatically. And if you take a country like Vietnam, it's quite remarkable that you had a government in Vietnam that fought the United States of America, that fought against capitalism, that believed in communism. And today, in some ways, Vietnam may be trying to be more capitalist than America itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's remarkable. That's an example of massive learning that is taking place.
How do Asian leaders look at the world today, and what are they contributing to some of the things we've been talking about?
Well, I think, and unfortunately, many Asian leaders are not aware that, you know, they've been relying on United States and Europe to provide global leadership. And United States and Europe actually, you know, in many ways, provided good global leadership in the 50s, 60s, 70s, setting out organizations like the WTO, which liberalized world trade. And so the Asian leaders got used to be followers rather than leaders. But today, frankly, since the Asian countries like China and India have become the biggest beneficiaries of open globalization, they can no longer afford to be followers. They need to become leaders. And that's also one of the messages I try to convey in my book, that you can no longer sit back and assume that somebody else is going to take care of the world that you're benefiting from. It's time for you to take on more global responsibilities.
There's been a reluctance on the part of Asian leaders to do that, a kind of insecurity almost at play.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think partly because the Asian leaders themselves are in a state of shock. They didn't expect to grow so fast and do so well and suddenly emerge as a leading economy so fast. I mean, one of the most stunning statistics I provide in my book is that, you know, in 1980, which is not that long ago, the United States share of the global GNP was 25%, and China's share of the global GNP was 2.2% in PPP terms, less than 10% that of the United States. But by 2017, which is 3 to 4 years from now, the United States share is going to fall to 17.6%, and China's share will grow up to 18.2%. So China's share of the global economy will become number one in PPP terms in 3 to 4 years' time. No one anticipated it, and I think even the Chinese leaders are a bit shocked by how fast it happened.
What are the new security threats within this global landscape?
Well, I think you have the traditional threats of terrorism, which, again, I'm confident we can take care of. And then you also have the traditional flashpoints like North Korea, South China Sea, and so on and so forth. But I actually, stands out in my book is that I actually believe that many of these problems can be solved if you are very careful and pragmatic in the way that you handle them. And of course, one of the most revolutionary things I say is that diplomacy was invented 2,000 or 3,000 years ago not to enable you to talk to your friends, but to enable you to talk to your enemies, because only your enemies will chop off your heads in a negotiation. So that's why diplomacy was established 2,000 years ago. So since the United States declares that North Korea and Iran are enemies of the United States of America, United States should logically establish diplomatic relations with North Korea and Iran. But as you know, that's almost unthinkable for United States to do. So what was common sense 2,000 years ago, United States cannot do today. And that's an example of lack of pragmatism.
How did that happen in your view? How did diplomacy get essentially a bad name?
Well, that's very sad because, you know, frankly, one reason, again, why the world is more peaceful today is because diplomacy is becoming more and more effective. And it is a fact that there is a correlation between the number of times that global leaders meet each other in a year and global peace. I mean, take, for example, the example of China and Japan, right, who, as you know, are going through a very difficult time now. But the reason why you have some confidence that the relationship will be managed is because the leaders of China and Japan will meet each other at least three or four times a year at the G20 meetings, at the APEC meetings, at the ASEAN meetings. And as a result of these meetings, they can talk to each other privately and ensure that the things don't go off the rails. In the past, this was very, very difficult. Every time you tried to get a meeting between the United States leader and the Soviet leader, it was so difficult. But now the most global leaders meet in many different places several times a year.
Is it your sense that we are on the verge of some significant changes to address these things that we've been talking about, or is this something you see very far down the road?
Well, this is where I hope my book will make a difference. I mean, the key goal of my book is to say, hey, wake up. The world has changed, and we've got to change to keep up with this different world. And amazingly, there are some very easy things we can do. I mean, for example, as you live together on the same boat, you really got to understand each other much better. And this is where we have a UN General Assembly, which serves as the parliament of the world. We have sadly bypassed it, ignored it, marginalized it. I'm saying don't marginalize the UN General Assembly. Have some real debates down there so you can understand each other better about why you all see the world differently.
Is the UN still an effective instrument to do that, or do we need to create new institutions?
No, I think the UN is still an effective instrument. And in fact, what's surprising is that most countries in the world outside the United States of America, including many European countries, still have a lot of faith in the UN. The reason why they have a lot of faith in the UN is that it is the most representative global body in the world. Everyone is represented in the UN. It is also perceived to be, for that same reason, the most legitimate body in the world. And frankly, I argue that now, frankly, it is in American interest to strengthen organizations like the UN. And that's why I begin the book by quoting what Bill Clinton said in a speech in Yale in 2003. And he very wisely said, if America assumes that it will be number one forever, then of course America should continue behaving unilaterally and do whatever it wants. But if America can conceive of the possibility of it becoming number two, then surely it is in American interest to create a rules-based order that will constrain the next number one. That was very wise of Bill Clinton to say that in 2003, and this is now 2013. The Americans should start implementing what he said.
Kishore Mahbubani, his book is The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Kishore, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.